is capable of amazing things. So that is the big difference, obviously, with training the body and the mind, is that the mind's potential is pretty much unlimited.
Welcome to Critical Mind, Embodied Spirit. Today we have a very special guest joining us all the way from the Tibetan Buddhist monastery Serajay in India, where he's been a monk for over a decade, studying and training in the Tibetan language on the Geshe degree program, an immensely rigorous course that takes about 20 years to finish. Philip Gallenberger talks about his extraordinary daily life, the secret of happiness, debate as an analytical approach to internalizing what the Buddha taught, the real meaning of emptiness, meditation, and a lot more. So make sure you hit the subscribe button and don't go away so you don't miss a thing. Welcome, Philip. Really great to have you here. I'm really excited to have Thanks. This opportunity to talk to you again.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been, hasn't it? Philip, so you've been a Buddhist monk living in the Tibetan monastery Serajay in southern India for the last 15 years now, is that correct?
It's my 14th year here now, yeah.
Ah, it's your 14th year.
I've been a monk a little longer than that.
Right.
But spent my first couple of years in Italy, as you know, with you as my classmate.
Yes.
And officially entered the monastery in 2008, I think, something like that. So anyway, I'm in the 14th year of the study program here now.
Okay, right. So you're studying and training alongside all of your Tibetan classmates, debating the finest details of the Buddha's teachings in Tibetan for hours a day. It sounds like an extraordinary life, but life wasn't always like this.
Yes.
You were born in Munich, Germany. Mm-hmm. It must seem like, to many people, an enormous sacrifice to change your lifestyle that much to become a monk. Did it feel like an enormous sacrifice?
No. Not at all. That's why, you know, for me, it was a gradual thing, you know. Obviously, if I'm a teenager living the life in Munich, and then somebody would tell me in a few years you're gonna be a Buddhist monk living in a monastery in India, I'd say, oh, that's no way, you're crazy. So obviously it seems, you know, crazy from that place in Munich to this place here. But it wasn't like that, you know. So for me, the gradual interest in meditation and Buddhist philosophy in general, it just continuously grew since I was like 16 or so. And eventually, you know, it led to me moving to Italy and then from there becoming ordained. And then from there, moving here to have the best place to study and meditate and live. So for me, it seems like the most logical thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine for many people listening, it must seem incredibly hard to give up the things that most people spend their lives pursuing. What was the hardest thing about becoming ordained?
I don't know. Obviously, I was
really that easy, huh?
Well, it really was quite easy. Like probably the relationship that I had, I'd say.
Yeah,
that was the hardest thing to give up, because it was very long-term relationship that I had. And it was a good relationship. So it was not like I had broken up with somebody and then I got fed up with relationships and then I decided to become ordained. It was nothing like that.
Right.
It was, I ended the relationship to, you know, become a monk. So probably that was the hardest thing to give up, I'd say. But yeah, for me, like I said, you know, it's... to finish the answer from the previous question, you know, for me it wasn't like a radical decision, a decision at all. Kind of for me it was just the most logical thing in the world. So when people ask me, for me I always have to kind of try to see things from their perspective, because to me it seems like, well, it's obvious. But obviously it's not, otherwise, you know, more people would be ordained.
Right, yeah. The process of becoming ordained, it seems to mirror the process of renouncing the world. And I think certainly, you know, in my own case, in the small things that I've renounced in the world, like behavioral or lifestyle changes that I've made as I've got older, they've often come about through sort of painful experiences where I've realized that I've been pursuing something that I thought would bring me happiness. But when I realized that it ultimately wouldn't bring me happiness, I felt a strong revulsion or rejection and wanted to sort of make a permanent change to reject that or those things of the world, let's say. So it would seem perhaps that many people would become ordained out of painful experiences, but you're saying that's not the case with you.
I agree that that is probably true for, well, at least Westerners, you know, who get ordained when they're like grown up or when they're like older. For young Tibetan kids who get ordained when they're small, you know, they don't really have a choice. You know, their parents send them to the monastery, and that's all they know. Which I sometimes think is an advantage, but certainly not always. But in my case, it wasn't like that. It wasn't that like I was like, you know, had a bad experience in lay life, or I had a bad breakup and then decided, okay, that's it. It's nothing like that. You know, it was just for me, I really wanted to focus on what I really enjoy doing.
Right.
So for me, if you... Of course, there's an aspect of renouncing things, but for me, it's more like an affirmative, you know, action that I now free up all my life and all my time, and I can focus it on what I really want to do.
Right.
So, for me, you know, it's like it gives the freedom to do what I want to do, really, rather than, you know, oh no, I have to give up all this other stuff I like to do, just that I can sit alone in a monastery and get bored. Obviously, that would be stupid.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, it's like I said before, it's about making priorities and then really doing what you want to do. Obviously, I was lucky to find what I really enjoy doing while I was still quite young. So that gave me, you know, a big advantage in that I can, you know, then focus on that and really do that. And then I have also time to really become good at that, because I found it so early. So I'm quite aware of that, and I'm also, I have to say, quite grateful for that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm really happy for you. So tell me, Philip, what does your average day look like in Serajay Monastery in India?
It really depends on what's happening at the moment. So you can imagine, I'll just talk a little bit about the monastery in general. So of course, if you know, anybody's interested, they can, you know, just look it up. But this monastery has a long history, you know, of obviously several centuries in Tibet, and then being reestablished here in the 70s and in the refugee community here down in South India. So the monastery in general is like basically a huge campus, like a university kind of campus, where there's a lot of people all studying the same curriculum and also all being monks. So it's basically like a giant monastic university, which is also what it's called, you know, it's called Serajay Monastic University. So the monastic curriculum is kind of divided up into various sections per year, where we do the allotted subjects for each year, or each class does their subject for the whole year. The general study program has 19 different classes, so each class does their own, you know, subject for about 8 months a year. And then for 2 months after that, we do a separate course about logic, and then also do a debate meeting with all the other big Gelugpa monasteries. And then for about 2 months or so, there's not really any official study programs going on after all the exams are finished. So that's a kind of a downtime, really, or you can, if you want to, you know, go somewhere, it's a good time to do that. So during this, 8 months of study program, or 10 if you want, the normal life is again depending on whether you are in the moment in an off session or in an on session. So the again, these 8 months, they're broken up into smaller, chunks. And then some of them are on sessions where we mainly focus on debating. So there will be debate in the morning and then debate in the evening. And in the afternoon, you have time to do your own studies or whatever. Whereas in the off sessions, the whole morning is that there's no morning debate, basically. That's the main difference. So you basically get the whole day to either, study or go to class or, memorize or do whatever you want, really. And my time, again, is a little bit different from, let's say, the most other monks here, is because I've got like my own little house here in the monastery. So I'm a little bit separate from most people who live in a kind of...
Is that because you're not Tibetan?
No, that's just because I have my own little house here. There's many people who do have their own little house. But obviously then you have to, find a way to finance your own little house. So, obviously then you can either, when you get here, you can either live in a kind of a dormitory situation, which is provided by the monastery, and food is also provided by the monastery, or, many people, they do have maybe they get together with some other people and they build their own little house. In my case, I did it by myself. It's on the monastery campus. It's just a little bit towards the outskirts, if you want.
Right.
So I'm somewhat independent, I also do make my own food mostly. So I mainly go and see other people during the debate sessions, and most of the other things I kind of do by myself, which I enjoy doing. So therefore also my normal schedule looks a little different than most other people here. But in general, in the morning, it's I have some meditation practices I do, and then do some study. And then if there's a debate in the morning, I go to debate, come home and make some lunch. And then in the afternoon, I might listen to some classes, either directly from my teachers, or I listen to the recordings that I have. And then make some dinner, and then in the evening go to debate. And sometimes there will be like prayer sessions. There are prayer sessions within the debate sessions, like the debate session is broken up into smaller chunks where either you debate one-on-one or where you debate in a group, or then prayer sessions. And then there will be like sponsored kind of prayer things, either with lunch or with dinner. But those are kind of voluntary. You don't have to go, but you can or you should, let's say.
Right.
But nobody's going to say anything if you're not going. It's up to you, basically. So I go to those occasionally, not always, because again, I like to cook my own food, and so I prefer not to go most of the times. So that's kind of what my day looks like, really. If I'm here in the study program, if I'm outside somewhere, I'll not really study much. Just I like to have a kind of a.
It sounds like you do an awful lot of debating.
Okay.
I think this is something that might be quite recognisable about Tibetan monks debating with each other. Perhaps people have seen one monk standing, and as he makes his point, clapping his hands towards another monk who's sitting on the floor, defending his position in the debate, whilst the other monk attacks the position in debate. And I'm really interested to hear more about this. What happens in these debating sessions?
Yeah, well, this, especially our tradition, the Gelug tradition, they kind of pride themselves on this practice of debate, which I think has also been taken up by most of the other schools, obviously not in this kind of framework and in this kind of length and rigorism that has existed in this tradition since 500 years or so. But it's basically an exchange of ideas, you know. So let's say I have about 100 classmates now. When I first got here, we were about 200. And most of them will go to, you know, various teachers who obviously always teach the same subject at the same time. Otherwise, you know, that would be kind of confusing. But let's say we have, there's a sort of curriculum where it's like from this date to this date, this and this class studies this and this subject. So then, of course, all of the teachers throughout the monastery, they will teach that subject at the same time, so that when you go to debate, you're actually, you know, all on the same page. So then, of course, different teachers will have different interpretations of certain whatever theses or subjects or interpretations. And then, of course, there's also a vast amount of texts and commentaries that you can read, written throughout the centuries, like going back to the original scriptures and then the Indian scriptures translated into Tibetan, and then early Tibetan commentaries and then later Tibetan commentaries by the Lama Tsongkhapa and his disciples, and then even like our text monastery textbooks, like written in the 16th century, and then all the way up to contemporary commentaries by modern scholars or by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and so on. So many people, you know, they have different capacity for reading various commentaries, and so when you go to debate, it's nice to find, you know, people either who are much, you know, more advanced than you, or just much more clever, or just put more effort into studies, and you can learn a lot from them doing, you know, lots of reading and having different ideas themselves. And then you can also debate with people who might ask you questions because they don't understand stuff, or you can see if you can explain something to them. And then you can have like very good spirited debates with people who are, you know, let's say on a similar intellectual level to you. So then it's kind of an equal, you know, fight if you want. It's like sparring. So this kind of debate works in a way of using syllogisms, right? You know? So the person,
but is there like a specific kind of methodology here that you're using?
Yes, there's a form. Yeah, there's a form to this. Like, you can't just say whatever you want. Basically, the person who is sitting down, if you're talking about this one-on-one debate, they will be asked a question by the person who is standing, and then you will answer that question, and that answer would be your thesis, if you want, like the thesis that you're then trying to defend, or the other way around, he's then trying to refute that thesis that you're holding. So in that way, you know, it's very nice, because you learn to defend the thesis, whether that be your actual opinion or not doesn't matter, and you also very much learn to not be attacked personally by somebody who's trying to attack a thesis that you're holding. That is a kind of a very good side effect of debate, that you learn to be objective and like not to take it personally if somebody, you know, shows you that the thesis that you're holding does not make sense whatsoever. So, you know, it's a very good intellectual tool to train your analytical thinking, and that you can also then use in your own personal meditation, or when you analyze things and so, and you do any kind of analytical meditation. It's basically like debating with yourself, you know. So it's a very useful tool for exploring these vast amounts of texts that we have in this tradition, and it's also, you know, a very good tool to sharpen your own mind.
Yes, it seems very attractive to, for want of a better word, Westerners who perhaps grew up with a very analytical approach to the world, or a very analytical approach to education. So I think, like, as meditation is also becoming more and more popular these days, as society at large becomes more and more aware of the benefits, and a lot of people might really be attracted to meditation and Buddhist techniques, and they may feel that they can really benefit their lives by following some of the Buddha's advice. But at the same time, maybe some people might feel it's really difficult to accept a religion, or may feel it's difficult to believe in many of the things in Buddhism that might lie outside of our direct experience, like other dimensions or something like that. So, I mean, you talk about the practice in the monastery as being essentially one that's built around debate and analysis. And yet there seems to be so many things in Buddhism that are beyond our direct experience. How do you reconcile these two? And what advice would you give to somebody who thinks critically and wants to approach these things?
You know, I mean, obviously the Buddha, he said that like a goldsmith, you should analyze, you know, like he analyzes the gold, you should analyze everything I say. And if it doesn't agree with you or it doesn't make sense, then you can disregard it, you know. So if the Buddha himself said something like that, then obviously, you know, that applies to anybody else. So, you know, if there's somebody who tells you something about Buddhism that sounds weird to you or that doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever, then, you know, you're free to disregard whatever that person says. So if a certain aspect of Buddhism appeals to you, let's say, a certain way of calming the mind or a certain technique of meditation or whatever, then obviously any person can use that. You know, there's no need to say I'm a Buddhist or you're not a Buddhist, therefore you cannot use breathing meditation to calm down when you have a panic attack or something like that. You know, so there's so many aspects to Buddhism that are not related to, let's say, like a religious aspect of the tradition, that are like just basically straight up useful techniques to train the mind. So anything that has to do with training the mind, you can use that, you know, irrespective of whether you're a Buddhist or not. And then also many philosophical assertions or points of view that Buddhism holds, let's say the importance of understanding the interdependent nature of things, or even practical aspects, you know, that is necessary to have loving kindness and compassion for everybody. All these things, they are useful and they are separated from, let's say, any kind of metaphysical assertions or, you know, whatever statements about past and future lives, or like you say, things that are outside of our direct perception, at least for the moment. So all those things that we would call like hidden or slightly hidden phenomena, all these things you can just put to the side and you can say, I don't know if they exist or not. And also at the moment, it doesn't really matter. You know, I can just later, maybe, you know, once my mind is more trained and, for example, I've got, you know, certain levels of concentration or whatever, then maybe I can see what this is about, or, you know, if that is true or not. But for now, you know, I cannot validate those things by either logic or direct experience. So for now, I can just put them to the side. What I can see is from the things that the Buddha taught that I can understand and that do make sense, you know, that for me is enough to have a certain level of trust or faith that, you know, there would be no need to make up stuff on his or from his side, you know, to say things that just don't make any sense or whatever, and that are not true. So for me, considering the Buddha a valid person, you know, there is a certain level of trust that I put in his scriptures and his teachings. But of course, they have to stand up to logical reasoning. You know, he said that. So, you know, within certain scriptures, you might find you know, descriptions of the earth or our physical environment that just do not correspond to what we can now see with direct perception. So obviously those things you can leave to the side. But also you can understand that these are not essential tenets of Buddhism. You know, I think many people, they get a little distracted with that because their tradition is so rich that sometimes you can get lost in some detail which really does not matter. You know, what is important is that, you know, you become a master of your own mind, you tame your mind, and you train yourself in loving kindness and compassion. That is important. That's really the essence of Buddhism. And that is very valid, and I think everybody can see that. So if there's things that you find within Buddhist texts or scriptures that seem to not make sense, then, you know, that's fine. You can just leave them to the side. But, you know, I think the more you enter into Buddhism and the more you understand what Buddhism is about, then the more you can benefit from it. And even if you're just looking at it as something, you know, of an outsider, or as just a person who is interested in training or understanding his own mind better, you know. So I think there's lots to gain from entering Buddhism with an open mind, whether you consider yourself a Buddhist or not.
Right. So do you think it would be possible to follow the Buddha's advice on things and practice some of the techniques without calling yourself a Buddhist?
Certainly, of course. Why not? I know lots of people, you know, that I would consider more Buddhist than maybe somebody who might actually call themselves, you know, Buddhist, but do not actually practice anything
right.
That has to do with loving kindness and compassion. You know, obviously, not all people who call themselves Buddhist are, you know, decent people.
Mm.
So, you know, there's many people, for example, also within people that I know that do not want to, you know, have anything to do with religion, but they can very much appreciate some of the things that Buddhism has to offer, such as, for example, the various ways of looking at the world as interdependent and the importance of training yourself in loving kindness and compassion and all these kind of things. So obviously these are not strictly Buddhist practices. You know, anybody can do them, and of course almost all the major religious traditions they teach loving kindness and compassion. So you know, there's many things that you can use from the tradition, even if you have you know, no wish to call yourself a Buddhist, or you do not consider yourself a Buddhist. That I don't see any problem with that.
Right. So you mentioned loving kindness and compassion, as well as interdependence. Those things strike me as core elements of what the Buddha taught. Maybe some of the listeners are already familiar with who the Buddha was and what he taught, but I'd be fascinated to hear, in your own words, what did the Buddha teach? If you could sum it up in, you know, 3 minutes, what would you say?
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's, you know, practicing loving kindness and understanding that yourself as well as everything else within the world is dependent on each other, you know. So these are really the two most essential things, you know. Being kind and not harming others is the best way to make yourself a happy and content person, really. And then understanding that, you know, all things, you know, in this world, they also, you know, need each other to exist, in a sense, you know, whether you're talking about the current state of the world or really anything. So for us to exist, we depend on other people, or we also depend on the kindness of other people. And then, you know, the way to have a good and healthy and whatever, fruitful, you know, connection with other people, you got to have some, you know, sort of loving kindness and compassion within you, you know. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to have any sort of relationship. So, to me, you know, Buddhism is about training your mind, really. That's what it is, really. You know, it's about training your mind in the sense that you can distinguish between, you know, things that appear to be true and how they are actually, you know, whether that be negative emotions that cloud your judgment, or whether that be assumptions about the world that seem obvious to you, but the more you enter into them, they might not be as obvious. Or really anything else, really. It's about training the mind, to be short. You know? That was probably more than 3 minutes, but...
No, that's brilliant. I loved it. Yeah. You said that loving kindness is the best way to look after yourself.
Oh yeah, I mean, to be loving and kind to others, you got to be loving and kind to yourself, you know, in the first place. You know, if you're very harsh and too strict on yourself, then it's quite likely that you might be that way towards others as well, you know. So and you can also see that from people who spend their lives mainly thinking about others. You know, those seem to be the most content and happy people. It just seems like that to me, you know. And I can see that also with people who are who are non-Buddhists. Like I remember talking to my dad about this, and he was working with the refugee kids in Munich who are coming to Europe, to Germany in their teens and are too young or too old to go to normal school. But you know, then there's a separate school for them where they get like a tutor. And my dad, he was tutoring some of those kids to get their degree. And he said, you know, for me, the reason I do that is because I know it benefits. So he said, I personally don't need to think about karma or past and future lives or whatever. I can just see it benefits. Therefore, I enjoy doing it and it makes me happy. You know, so that's already, you don't need to believe in past and future lives and whatnot to understand how being kind and helpful to others is useful, be it for them or for yourself, really.
Yeah, it seems like human beings have an almost equal propensity or capacity for loving kindness and empathy, as well as for the desire to dominate or to take more than we need, to occupy other human beings' welfare, or to take what's not ours. And it might seem to many people that life is competitive, like fundamentally competitive. It's a competition. And in order to be happy, you need to dominate more, or you need to somehow beat other people, or win the competition of life by besting other people. Do you think there's any happiness to be found in that, in getting more for yourself? Like, why isn't that a source of happiness, do you think?
Well, maybe, I mean, maybe to a certain extent, maybe to a certain extent. Like, you know, if you, for example, you strive to be like the best, you know, doctor or whatever, and you put a lot of effort in this and you master your field, you know, maybe that give you some sort of satisfaction. For sure, why wouldn't it? But of course, that is different than what you were talking about. Is more like being greedy in a sense, or you know, just wanting or craving for more. But of course, the craving will not get less with the more things you get, you know, or the more money you get or whatever. We just get more. You know, this illusion that people who have more are happier, that is just an illusion. I think that's is not a difficult one to disguise, you know. Just because you're rich or because you have a lot of stuff, it does not make you happier. I'd probably assume the opposite. I mean, I wouldn't know, but from what I can see, is that being rich and having a lot of stuff and a lot of people around you and you know, whatever, does not make you necessarily a happy person at all. So, you know, what does is being happy with what you have and being content. So obviously, you know, there's this misconception about, you know, Buddhism renouncing any kind of material stuff or material things and whatnot. That is only partly true. You know, obviously material things and money and food and whatnot is necessary to exist in this world.
Of course.
So you need to have a certain amount of material things. But of course they have to be, you know, useful to your life rather than becoming your life, you know. Rather that you then just exist for the stuff that you own and you work to whatever, pay your mortgage and pay your whatever car payment and whatever. So that you then end up just, you know, existing to work to pay for the stuff that you want to own because you think it makes you happy. Obviously that is not very, you know, smart. But you know, I think being ambitious and having a good motivation and wanting to achieve something that is not contradictory with Buddhism at all, you know.
Right.
But of course, this idea of being of greed and just, you know, that is of course a mental affliction that, you know, one should try to reduce and possibly eliminate.
So where does emptiness fit in to all of this? I think we hear about emptiness a lot, not just in Buddhism, but also in other spiritual traditions like Taoism, maybe. I mean, the word emptiness gets thrown around a lot. And I'm really interested to ask you this because I know that you're a few years into the systematic study of emptiness in perhaps the most in-depth analytical education system or framework that's available here on the planet Earth. So where does emptiness fit into all of this discussion about loving kindness and interdependence and these basic principles of Buddhism?
Well, basically emptiness and interdependence are, you know, two sides of the same coin, really.
Okay.
If you're talking about emptiness does not mean nothingness. You know, emptiness means being empty of inherently existing, you know. So the idea is, you know, that the best reason to establish what we call emptiness is understanding the interdependent relation of things or whatever, dependent arising or however you want to call it. So the reasoning of, because, you know, things are dependent on be it their own cause or being it on the mind that apprehends them or being it on labeling or whatever. So there's various levels, obviously, to this dependent arising thing. Therefore, they are empty of existing inherently. So obviously now you're thinking this sounds very abstract, you know, how is this useful for my life?
Yes.
But of course it is very useful, you know, because whenever something appears to us, you know, it tends to appear as a very solid kind of concrete thing, and it is this way and it can't be possibly any other way. So for example, the more you study and the more you, for example, think about how you perceive things, whether that be, you know, other people or what you thinking they are thinking of you or any kind of conceptual thought that appears to you, you know, the more you analyze those, you can realize that there is mostly not like it appears to you. So basically this kind of appearance versus reality is an analysis of what do you want to say, emptiness or ultimate truth, you know. So the more you go into this and the more you think about it, you end up with the conclusion that actually there's nothing whatsoever that exists independently or inherently, and therefore all things are empty of that inherent existence. And then, you know, once you come to that conclusion and you focus on that conclusion and you continue this debate internally, like with yourself, and you come to the conclusion, well, actually, yes, all things are empty of inherent existence and therefore are interdependent, and you focus on this, you know, and then try to single-pointedly meditate on this, then that would be like a conceptual meditation on emptiness, which ideally, of course, if it is done by a mind that has a certain level of concentration, will lead to a certain meditative, you know, equipoise, or like a meditative absorption, where you're meditating really on emptiness, and then the mind and that object appear or are supposed to appear as like mixed together, and you're basically just meditating in that state. So this obviously is very useful to reduce all the like concrete like concepts that we have in the mind, and it also, you know, goes directly at the root of this egotistical attitude or this idea of holding a concrete independent self that we do have. So that, you know, goes right to cutting the root of all the negative afflictions and so forth that are present in our mind, whether that be anger or greed or whatever. So once you realize that I that we perceive or that person that we perceive to be inherently existent, it does not really exist at all in that way, you know, that very much cuts off the legs of this of all the negative emotions that arise in the mind. So therefore, you know, meditating on emptiness is very much useful, you know, in even in normal day life, you know.
So you said that when you analyze the way things really are, they seem not to exist in the way they appear to your mind. So let's be ruthlessly practical here. So if I look at my phone, for example, it appears to exist. Mm-hmm. It's in my hand, you know, I can use it. It's certainly not something else, like a cup of water. So how is it that it's not existing in the way that it appears to my mind?
Well, certainly it appears to your mind as a phone, and if in conventional reality, it functions as a phone and is conventionally labeled in the English language as phone.
Mm.
Therefore, you know, it's correct to call it a phone, and it is a phone that exists, you know, separate from you and separate from your mind. So obviously, I'm not saying that your phone is not a phone. I'm not saying your phone is not existent.
Okay.
It's what our mind tends to project on top of this, you know.
Right.
There's layers to this, you know, like to everything, there's layers, you know. So you know, things appear in a very concrete way. Like, for let's do another example of one where, for example, this sense of I will become very strong, which is normally when it is like challenged or something. If somebody, for example, harm, you know, you perceive somebody is harming you,
yes,
or somebody you care about or whatever, then that I that we have and this what's it appears to be very, very much as a concrete thing. Like, for example, you know, you're getting, for example, angry or upset at that person because we are 100% sure that they are harming us, or something that is mine. In that sense, you know, this I and mine thing then becomes very strong, and it appears very much like a concrete entity.
Yes.
So that, obviously, there is us and there's other people. There's two separate, you know, continuous. But, you know, the more the negative minds then, you know, become strong in your continuum, the more those appear to be completely separate and independent. So that is a sort of misconception, you know, that we put on top of things, like whether that be external objects or mental emotions or the eye or anything, you know, anything that appears to our, let's say, untrained mind appears in a very concrete and self-existent way. And that is let's say, the misconception that is dispelled by, you know, thinking and meditating on emptiness.
Wow. So you've very eloquently just summed up the core ideas that the Buddha taught. I wonder whether they're the same in other traditions of Buddhism. So you mentioned that you're a monk in the Gelug tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And according to what I know, there are four different traditions in Tibetan Buddhism. Is there a big difference between Gelug and the other schools or traditions of Tibetan Buddhism in the way that they think about what the Buddha taught?
No, I would say definitely no. There might be different ways of explaining things, and certainly within the Tibetan traditions, there's different ways of going about studying the Buddhist teachings. Ours is certainly the one with the most like intellectual approach that puts the most emphasis on first, you know, really studying a lot and then focusing on meditation as you proceed along.
Ah.
Like they're very definite on that. For the average person, it is very essential to first really study well, to then later, you know, succeed in their efforts at meditation.
I see.
But there are certainly other approaches to that that are, you know, less, if you want to say, conceptual, and some that teach, you know, meditation right from the start, maybe in combination with intellectual studies. I'm not saying that we, in our tradition, that is not the case at all. But of course, the formal study program that we have here at the monastery is very much an intellectual study program.
Yes,
where it's all about, you know, studying. But of course, you're supposed to, you know, apply what you learn to your own mind and to your own practice. Obviously, sometimes that seems difficult if you're studying some very abstract, you know, subject. But in general, I do not consider that the four Tibetan schools to have any substantial difference in terms of philosophical opinion or tenet, if you want. And there are certainly other schools of Buddhism which would explain especially what, you know, we term this ultimate reality or whatever, like if you're talking about how things exist or the mode of existence of things, that would certainly be explained differently in different traditions, you know, some especially if you're looking at the mind-only tradition. Chittamatra schools, they will explain that quite differently. And then also within the Theravada tradition, there will be obviously different explanations. But in general, like the fundamental tenets of Buddhism, I do not consider them to be any different within the different traditions. You know, it's all about the three higher trainings. It's all about training in morality, having good ethics, training your mind in concentration, and then training in wisdom. Whether that, you know, be learning about emptiness or the selflessness of persons or you know, whatever. But in general, there do not seem to me to be any fundamental differences at all.
Yeah. Do you think there's any advantage to taking a really intellectual approach at the very beginning rather than going straight into meditation before you've done a lot of study?
That's an interesting question. I think for people like you and me, who are, you know, very much enjoying intellectual conversation and debating endlessly about, you know, the most minute point, that approach is certainly a good one.
Yeah.
For many other people who might not be, you know, that into debating and overanalyzing stuff, probably another approach is better.
Yes.
But you know, the nice thing about Buddhism is there is it's not one way to do stuff. You know, there is a different way to practice Buddhism for everybody. So whether that be through, like, you know, there's all these stories in the teachings about, you know, somebody who just sweeps the stairs in front of the temple for 20 years and then suddenly, you know, they have a realization of, I don't know, whatever, you know, so there obviously has to be some kind of you know, balance, let's say, between when you say, an accumulation of merit or like just engaging in virtuous activity, really. That can be any kind of virtuous activity, and then the intellectual, like, training in wisdom part.
Right.
So ideally there has to be some kind of balance, but of course what that balance looks like is very different for every individual.
So, moving on, in other fields of study, people are quite clear about what they've achieved and where they are along a specific path of study or training. In Buddhism, the precise stages of the path are very clearly laid out. But we almost always hear practitioners, even the greatest or most respected practitioners out there, say that they're still at the very beginning, or that they have no realizations. Why do you think that is?
Well, if I get any, then I'll tell you. I imagine that could be several reasons. One reason could be that it's just more relatable to people.
Okay.
People seem, you know, if you see somebody who is, you know, sort of on your level or kind of seems to be in the same boat as you, it can be inspirational.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, I remember His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, talking about why for him it's very inspirational to see, like, Lama Tsongkhapa as just a normal, ordinary person, not somebody who was enlightened.
Sorry, who is Lama Tsongkhapa? Could you just say?
Lama Tsongkhapa is the founder of our school of Tibetan Buddhism. He's a sort of a reformer of the Tibetan tradition, if you want. So he's in the 15th century, whatever, formed this, you know, Gelug school or whatever, and the Gelug tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, which also, the Dalai Lama is part of and has been sort of the official, if you want, you know, lineage since the ascent of the Dalai Lama to the throne in Lhasa, which has been like that for, you know, many centuries. So
the Yellow Hats.
Well, yeah, that is a very funny name. Yeah, that was given by, I don't know, some early Tibetologist. Yeah, which doesn't make any sense, really.
It doesn't
Gelug
really.
Gelug means the virtuous system.
Ah, you know, okay.
It's just what it means. It's just it's the name of this tradition. You know?
Yeah.
It's also called the Ganden tradition because the first monastery was a Ganden monastery, founded at this place called Ganden, so therefore the tradition is also called, you know, Ganden, whatever, Ganden or whatever.
But you do see lamas wearing yellow hats, and is that unique to Gelug or not?
Yes, but not exclusively in our tradition. So calling everybody that wears a yellow hat doesn't, or Gelugpa, doesn't make much sense. But anyways, you know, the difference in the tradition is not wearing different various funny colored hats, you know.
Okay.
That's not the distinguishing.
Although they do look quite cool.
They do look pretty, yeah, swanky with the kind of style, yeah, whatever. I remember the Dalai Lama saying that for him personally, it's more inspiring to think of Lama Tsongkhapa as just an ordinary person who then through his, you know, incredible efforts in accumulation of merit and studying and listening to, you know, so many of his teachers, and then, you know, composing all those works, and then engaging in serious meditation practice, and then eventually attain enlightenment. So to him, he says that is much more inspiring, because he can say, well, I'm just like that, you know, I'm trying to inspire after, you know, Lama Tsongkhapa. Whereas if you, for other people, it might be more inspiring, you know, if they think of Lama Tsongkhapa as somebody who is just, you know, an emanation of some deity or whatever, somebody who has been enlightened since the, whatever, since, you know, some past life, or and then they, for them, you know, seeing it like that, they get more inspired by that. So for me personally, I'm in that same boat, that if I consider Lama Tsongkhapa, or basically really all my teachers that are around now, I also consider them just to be, you know, ordinary monks in the beginning, and just ordinary kids, and then through hard effort and study and practice in this life, they gain you know, certain levels of realization. So to me, that is very inspiring, because then I think, well, why can I do that, you know? So in the sense of, it seems more easy to emulate. But why a certain individual that does have certain realizations will not talk about it, that can have several reasons, you know, either that is not really feasible, or also it might be very difficult to understand for other people who do not have those realizations. Maybe amongst each other they do talk, it's quite likely actually that amongst each other they do talk about, you know, certain, you know, realizations, or how to get to higher planes or whatever. So if you're talking to this, you know, one-on-one with your teacher or with other practitioners, then that might be a more open conversation. But just you know, stating to somebody, I have this and that and this realization, for monks also is not really permissible.
Do you think it might be more helpful if practitioners were a little bit more open about exactly what they've achieved to the outside world, so that people who wanted to study from somebody who was at a particular level, for example, could directly seek them out and get specific instruction from somebody who was at a specific level, rather than guessing, or, as a friend of mine once said, working on an economy of gossip and whispers?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I have a friend here. He said when he realized emptiness, he's going to tell everybody. you know, maybe there's, maybe people have different different approaches to that.
Yeah.
But of course, I don't know.
What are the potential dangers here, though, with maybe telling everybody what realizations you've attained?
Also, I don't know. There might be some hindrances or something come up in the path for you. I think that might be possible.
What do you mean?
Well, I really don't know. For me, anyway, if it's kind of a work in progress, I prefer to keep it to myself. In the sense that, you know, I don't like to talk about stuff that I'm doing which is not finished yet. Maybe it's something like that, you know. But I do not know. Really, I'm not qualified to answer the question. Really.
Okay, it seems like a bit of a taboo to tell everybody that you've attained a certain realization, and it's certainly very rare to hear of somebody claiming to be at a certain level in meditation in the Buddhist tradition anyway, and I wonder...
I don't know, maybe amongst Westerners it's not that uncommon, but then I'm also sometimes not so sure about those claims. If somebody claims to, to me anyway, if somebody claims I have this and that and this realization, to me that is more like a confirmation that they actually don't. But you know, who am I? Who am I? I don't know. I cannot read other people's minds yet.
Fair enough. Why is that? Why does it seem to be a confirmation that they haven't actually attained that level?
Well, to me, first, obviously, because there is a certain, you know, maybe that's just being me being like suspicious. But, you know, obviously there is examples of, you know, people who are using this kind of statements to then, you know, mislead other people for their own personal gain. And then also I can see all the examples of my teachers and all the High Lamas in the Tibetan tradition that are, you know, not talking about this, about their personal attainments. So then if some people do, that naturally makes me suspicious. That's just me.
Some people that I know talk about having achieved the jhanas. And I don't know whether I'm pronouncing that word correctly. But I think it's a Sanskrit word, and I think it translates to level of concentration. What are the jhanas, and how would you know if you've achieved them?
Well, since I do not know Sanskrit, I also don't know if you pronounce this word correctly in Tibetan. Anyway, they are called samten and samjuk. It's about certain levels of meditative concentrations and then absorptions, nyomju, which you can attain, you know, to basically just practicing single-pointed meditation, which are also not unique to Buddhist practitioners. These explanations and practices also exist among Hindu practitioners and others. So the very first, or the first stepping stone to the first of those concentrations, is that for 4 hours you can single-pointedly hold an object in your mental concentration in front of your mind. So if you can do that, then you probably are close to achieving the first of those concentrations. Yeah.
So 4 hours without checking Facebook or getting a cup of tea or...
Well, no. let alone checking Facebook, it means you make a mental image in front of your mental eye. It's not an eye consciousness. You can't have a concentration that is focused on any of the five sense objects. It's a mental image. Let's say you make a clear image in front of your mental eye of, let's say, a Buddha statue or whatever, a little butter lamp or a candle or whatever. And then you're able to focus on this with clarity for 4 hours straight.
Without it being broken.
Without, yeah, being distracted or losing it. That would be the entry level. So if they can do that, then congratulations to them.
Okay, so that's the first level of concentration, the first jhana.
Yes. Is the stepping stone to the first, yeah.
Are there any other signs?
Yes, there will also be signs that you will no longer have any what we call manifest afflictions of the desire realm. So if some person were to have this level of subtlety of mind, then even if they come out of that meditative concentration and just, you know, whatever, walk around or, you know, take care of their daily business, they would, at least for the time being, not have any... you know, strong not any negative emotions such as anger and so forth. So, you know, you can check for yourself, you know,
mean none at all?
Yeah, for the time being.
Okay.
None at all, yeah. Unless they stop training and then that concentration can degenerate, then it will come back. So because this is not it's not a path, and that is supra mundane. Also, it's not necessarily conjoined with this wisdom of realizing emptiness. So therefore, also, it's not an exclusively Buddhist path. So these can degenerate. So if you then stop training, for example, or you engage in a lot of, like, you know, negative emotions or whatever, you know, you take up negative habits that are contrary to you know, training in training in concentrations such as, or, you know, whatever, going around killing people or whatever, you know, strong negativity, then those will degenerate very quickly. And then also the afflictions, they will come back.
But what if you don't do that and you have reached the first jhana? You shouldn't have any manifest afflictions like anger or strong desire.
No, you don't. Then you no longer have what we call desire realm afflictions, which our human realm is classed as part of the desire realm, which is called so because, you know, beings within this are mainly, you know, guided by either being attached to stuff or being averse to stuff. So there's very strong emotions, you know, negative emotions involved. But that's why this whole realm, with also animals and whatever other beings, this is all classed as the desire realm. So if you, whereas those eight jhanas are outside of that. So if you have any of those levels, then you will no longer, for the time being at least, have any manifest afflictions pertaining to the desire realm.
Right. Yeah. Sounds very otherworldly, very different from my own
experience.
So, Philip, you've talked quite a lot about training the mind. I'm quite interested. What about the body? As a human being, we're embodied in a physical human body. What role does the body play in Buddhist training?
Well, in my opinion, it should play a let's say, important role. Obviously, you know, being a monk, there is a certain level of training in your body, in the sense that you do not engage in activities that harm your own body, you know, such as whatever, drinking or whatever. Also that you do not use your body to engage in negativity such as killing or, you know, whatever. Any harming others or, you know, whatever. You're supposed to, you know, abandon all those anyways, you know. But of course, even more so when you take up the monk vows. But more than that, like for any kind of mental training, is in my opinion, is important to take care of the body. Mm. You know, just like I normally, when people ask about, you know, the point of meditation, I use the analogy of a body in the sense that you know, we train the body to do stuff, or, you know, to try to, you know, be fit and be healthy. So in the same way, we can, you know, think of meditation in the sense of that as training the mind, like keeping the mind, you know, fit and flexible and nimble.
Yes.
And then the only difference being that our body naturally, you know, kind of degenerates with time, and just, you know, from the genetics that we are born with, we have certain limitations. Like, you know, for example, I couldn't play in the NBA or something just because I'm too short, you know, and I'm not fit enough. But so, you know, no amount of training will get me to the NBA. I can tell you that. But, you know, the mind obviously has a much greater capacity. So,
right.
You know, you have much less limitations with the mind. You know, you can achieve amazing things with the mind, you know, if you continue the training.
Yeah.
And many of those are even outside of what we think is possible now. This is why, you know, many things such as those jhanas and stuff that we are talking about, they seem very abstract and impossible now. But, you know, the mind is capable of amazing things. So that is the big difference, obviously, with training the body and the mind, is that the mind's potential is pretty much unlimited. But, of course, to answer the question, you know, to have the time and the opportunity to do that, you have to have some kind of, you know, healthy body. So obviously it's good to take care of your body. Obviously in our, you know, Western world now, this has become like an extreme of, like, you know, worshipping really the body and, you know, doing everything for looking good. So obviously that is not really, you know, helpful. It's just people become obsessed with their body, which is pretty, you know, not very useful, let's say, because, you know, naturally it will degenerate, it will get old, and eventually it will look ugly, you know. So that is just the way things are going for us. So, you know, it's good to take care of the body and not harm your body and give your body time to rest, you know, because it is, for now at least, you know, the basis on which you train your mind. So, you know, you have no other choice than take care of it and sleep well, eat well. You know, obviously not overindulge and stuff, but, you know, you got to be smart. Got to be smart about it.
Wow. Wow, that was incredible. Very insightful. And just fascinating to hear your perspective on these topics. And generally, just wonderful to hear about your experience in life. I think it's quite different from most people's experience listening to this. And yet there's a tangible sense of really universal truths peering through in what you said. I feel like we've just about opened Pandora's box, but let's wrap it up there.
Cool.
I'd really love to have you back on the show so we could go into more detail on many of the things that you've brought up today. Anyway, thank you so much for talking to us today, Philip.
You're very welcome. It's nice to talk to you again. It's been a while.
If you liked this content, make sure you hit the subscribe button to hear more from Critical Mind, Embodied Spirit. See you in the next show.